The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And the principle was that if you can't exercise your liberties, there's no point in having a republic at all. You know, they want to go, let them go. They want to walk, that is their deep, you know, fundamental right, at least to talk about doing that. And that's a kind of extraordinary perspective that's hard to imagine subsequent presidents adopting. But to me, that is the most significant takeaway for Madison. He had seen the Sedition Act. He did not want to do that. He genuinely did not repress freedom of speech. And he tried to fight the war that he did fight within the realm of Republican principles. He still believed in the possibility of a relatively limited government, and he did want to expand U.S. territory, but he did not want the U.S. to become a global superpower. That Hamiltonian vision was still more than a century away.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 16th, 2017. President James Madison shaped the course of American history in not one, not two, but three different and foundational roles in the formation of the young republic. He was a drafter of the Constitution, a leader of the Democratic Republican Party, and America's first wartime president. In a sweeping biographical account, Noah Feldman traces Madison's distinct roles and their resonance in current politics in his new book, The Three Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President. Jack Goldsmith recently interviewed Feldman on the book. Together, they discussed Madison's dynamic role in shaping America's Constitution, his influence on national security, including the use of economic sanctions, and much more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 269, Noah Feldman on Madison's Three Lives.
So, Noah, we're going to focus on national security and foreign affairs for Lawfare, but can you just tell us in general what the Three Lives are about?
Absolutely, and thanks for having me, Jack. The Three Lives start with Madison's invention of the Constitution, in real part because of foreign affairs interests. He's primarily concerned in the run-up to the convention about the difficulty of coordinating a single national trade policy. And the ongoing danger that some states will defect. And so the need for an effective national government in the first instance, this is before Madison comes up with his famous worry about the tyranny of the majority, is actually the question of creating a unified foreign policy.
And this was the problem under the Articles, I take it.
Central problem under the Articles. And as background to that, the way I tend to think of it is that the British Empire functioned a bit like a trade union, like the European Union or like NAFTA. So when the United States declared independence, it was essentially doing a form of Brexit. It was leaving the trade union, and suddenly it no longer had access, unfettered access, to all the ports where all of the trade of the former colonies typically was going. And the British, of course, were going to enforce that because they were angry about American independence. And so that was a central struggle for the early republic, and Madison was focused on it.
And the national government under the Articles didn't have the authority to force a uniform national trade policy.
Correct.
So that's
part one of the book.
Yeah.
That's the first life. The first life is then the creation of the Constitution, his coming across the idea of the tyranny of the majority, and his fundamental belief that he had created a Constitution that would solve the problem of faction and political parties once and for all.
He wasn't right about that.
He was not right about that. And the second life is what happened when Madison actually enters government in the House of Representatives, and having designed what Richard Hofstadter famously called a Constitution against parties, he very quickly finds himself forming a political party with Jefferson, the Democratic Republicans, the Republican Party, in order to go toe-to-toe with Hamilton. And to begin with, their disputes are domestic. They're about the constitutionality of the bank, and they're about the desirability of what Hamilton called a permanent national debt, an immortal national debt. But very quickly, they also become foreign policy disputes, because the Federalists are essentially pro-British. Hamilton wants to be allied with Britain. He wants to become Britain and supersede Britain. And Madison and Jefferson are pro-French, especially once the French Revolution starts, because they then see the French as just copying them and creating their own constitutional institutions.
Okay, so I want to come back later in a bit and talk about that episode in particular and the famous Pacificus Helvidius debate that grew out of the Neutrality Proclamation. But tell us about the Third Life first, and then we'll go back to the first.
Absolutely. The Third Life is Madison's 16 years on foreign policy. 8 years as Secretary of State from 1801, when Jefferson assumed the presidency, through 1809 when he became president, and then 8 years as president from 1809 to 1817. And in that period, Madison is really centrally focused on doing for the Republican foreign policy what he believed he had already done domestically. And that is solving the basic question: if a republic cannot have a standing army, which he firmly believed, and if a republic cannot have a large, stable navy, which he also firmly believed, because both of those would turn you into an empire and break the republic, then how can it make other countries do anything? And that was the central challenge, and his central approach to that was economic sanctions, which he experimented with every which way but loose, and he ultimately ended up taking the United States into its first declared war, the War of 1812.
Okay, great. So let's go back to the beginning. So you don't speak much in the book about, I believe, about the war power in particular, but could you tell us, there was a famous exchange in Madison's notes in which, to this day, it's not well understood, in which the word, I think, make war was taken out and declare war was put in. And Madison famously said that doing that with Gary, he said, doing that would allow the president to repel sudden attacks. You don't focus on that. You focus on solving this collective action problem and Madison's role in that. Could you tell us about what he was thinking, just a little bit more than he did in the introduction, and what his solution was and whether it worked?
Yeah. We tend to think of the Constitution in terms of the protection of rights. And Madison slowly, gradually did develop the idea that the Constitution would be an effective tool for structural protection of minorities against the tyranny of the majority. But that is not what he went into the convention aiming primarily to do. He went into the convention aiming primarily to allow the United States to function as a single unified government, and primarily that meant with respect to foreign affairs. And for that, he needed a solution that would preserve the existence of the states while simultaneously transferring tremendous amount of power to the central government. And that's why he hit on this idea of breaking sovereignty into parts and allowing the central government to act directly on individual citizens, thereby being able to tax them, thereby being able to have the money to actually do stuff. And that was his greatest insight, and it was the thing he was most focused on. He was so focused in the convention on central federal power that he also believed in the necessity of what he called the national negative, a federal veto probably to be exercised by Congress on all state legislation that was unliked by Congress. And he tried again and again and again in the convention to get that, and he never got it.
Right.
And that's an important episode because it shows that the centralization, which was characteristic of Madison in this first period, was being resisted already by states, especially by the small states.
So the one thing that surprises me about that account, and we'll get to this in a second, is Madison, although he clearly contemplated this massive transfer of power to the federal government, did he foresee this super powerful presidency growing out of Article II? We'll get to the neutrality debate in a second. But if you're going to have a unitary foreign policy, one of the weaknesses under the Articles was the absence of an independent executive and really weakness in having a coherent foreign policy. They created this independent executive branch. How could he not have foreseen, with this transfer of power to the federal government and this kind of vaguely empowered executive branch, that it would grow into what it became? Or did he, and
so
just discount
it? He did not foresee it. And when others warned against it in the convention, he essentially laughed at them. And let me try to explain why.
Please.
Because when he got it so spectacularly wrong, it deserves an explanation.
Yes.
What Madison viewed was a system that was pulling itself apart. The great danger was too much power in the states, the whole thing flying off. And he wanted to create a central gravitational pull in the middle. And that pull, he had no doubt in his mind, would be Congress. And the reason he thought that the president unilaterally would have very little capacity to turn into some kind of a monarch is that he knew that it was up to Congress to give that president any tools. And at the time, Congress had not given the president any tools, and it would not for well over 100 years, and in some, by some measures, almost another 150 years. So his view was that there was no great reason to worry about the executive unless, this is the big unless, you suddenly had a standing army or a navy. If you had those things, the president would become a Roman emperor and it would be the end of the world. But as long as you denied the president those things, the actual executive wasn't very dangerous. And I have to say, I believe that in historical terms, this was a correct assessment. The rise of the imperial presidency only begins to seem coherent when the president has domestically a large bureaucracy to execute what he wants to do, and in foreign affairs, where he has a substantial standing military that he can deploy even without congressional say-so.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's the rise of the standing army that destroyed, or that really destroyed this conception of the presidency. And yet, even before the rise of the standing army, which started growing early on and grew over time pretty steadily, you know, early in the 1790s, George Washington makes quite clear that you don't actually need a standing army to have a giant impact on foreign policy, and that the president's office alone and the president's speech alone and diplomatic determinations could have a huge impact on foreign policy with lots of impacts on domestic law. And this is, of course, his famous neutrality proclamation.
Yep.
So could you just walk us through that, tell us what Madison's reaction was?
Madison saw with the neutrality proclamation pretty much what you just said, namely that there was an unanticipated way that the president could make major interventions in foreign affairs without the acquiescence of Congress.
So just tell the readers what the neutrality proclamation
was.
Yeah,
so without, in the ongoing, one of the first iterations of the long ongoing war between Britain and France, the question was which position would the United States favor? And the United States, of course, had a treaty of amity with France, which in theory required us to come to France's aid under some circumstances. But Washington declared unilaterally that the United States would remain neutral in the conflict, which was perceived by Madison and Jefferson and others as essentially a pro-British move. So, you know, we tend to think of Washington in terms of the principle of neutrality, both the Neutrality Proclamation and then his famous farewell address where he warns us to avoid foreign entanglements. To the Republicans of the time, Madison and Jefferson, those were explicit pro-British interventions. That is how they saw them. To be neutral actually meant to forsake the alliance with France and to serve the interests of Britain.
And they rested, I think Madison and Jefferson believed, on an extraordinary assumption of executive power.
And that was really the shocking thing, I think, from Madison's perspective. And his reaction immediately to the Neutrality Proclamation was, wait, you can't do this, because this is essentially the equivalent of taking a treaty position or maybe repudiating a treaty position, and for that, you would need congressional approval.
Right.
And this led to a major problem for Madison because he had essentially overlooked in the constitutional structure the depth and capacity of the president's capacity to be able to be truly unilateral. And this led him into this famous set of exchanges with Hamilton over the nature of the presidency and foreign affairs power, and it's the only significant exchange between Madison and Hamilton on a constitutional question where I think you have to say, and I say this in the book, Hamilton gets the better of the argument.
He does get the better of the argument. I've always thought that. There are several interesting things about your account of the so-called Pacificus Helvidius debate, which was this debate between Hamilton and Madison over the legality of the Neutrality Proclamation. One is just how you tell the familiar story about Jefferson telling him to take up his pen and Madison doing it. But I had not realized with what trepidation Madison approached the task. He really didn't want to have
really
this fight
did not want to do
with,
it
with Hamilton. Why was that? Was that because he feared Hamilton, because he didn't think he had the better of the argument?
Yeah, it was a combination of both things. He had been fighting Hamilton forever, and he never minded doing it in the past. He always felt pretty confident doing it in the past because he was sure, especially when it came to construction of the welfare clause of the Constitution, that he was right. You know, Hamilton kept on saying, we can do whatever we want in Congress. And Madison kept on saying, it's a government of limited powers. I know I was there. On this point, I think Madison truly understood that, you know, frankly, he didn't have the better of the argument. But there was another matter which also I think was very significant, and that was Madison was deeply afraid, and correctly, of alienating Washington. And even the name that he took, you know, these we tend to think of these Latin names as kind of cute and silly, but they all were loaded with meaning. Publius had meaning, and Helvidius had meaning too, because Helvidius had been a Roman republican and a Stoic philosopher who addressed the emperor Vespasian by his personal name rather than by calling him Caesar Augustus, and who had also rejected the authority of the emperor's edicts. And this got him exiled and executed. And Madison was sort of hinting there that he knew he was calling Washington on foreign affairs power. And Washington deeply believed in the Constitution. He had been there. He was identified with the Constitution. And the hint or the implication that he was overreaching his constitutional powers made him crazy. And Madison didn't want to go there because he was trying to preserve the shreds of his relationship with Washington, which was very badly damaged by then. And he didn't. In the end, the upshot of those letters was the ultimate alienation of Madison and Washington, who had been extremely close. And they never really spoke again for the rest of Washington's life.
That's one of the many things I learned in that episode. I had not realized that, and it never even occurred to me, although when you say it, it makes perfect sense. The other thing one senses between the lines of your account of Pacificus and Helvidius, and this ties into something you said earlier, is the horror with which Madison, in reading Hamilton's arguments, must have realized, you know, never having looked at Article 2 that way in this context, the horror of the implications of Madison's really quite capacious interpretation of Article 2. And you sense that that was part of his anxiety in taking this on.
Absolutely right. He just hadn't seen that angle. And this, of course, deepened during the Quasi-War with France, where Adams was, you know, effectively conducting a war that was undeclared.
And it was Madison authorized, though. I mean, the Supreme Court held its authorization, and it was Congress had appropriated for, on one view of the Constitution, is exactly what it's supposed to be.
Yep.
Congress had appropriated to build a little navy and to do certain things out at sea, and implicitly you couldn't do other things. And yet Madison thought this was a constitutional solecism.
Yeah, he thought that a war was a war was a war, and the notion of quasi was simply a way of, you know, denying that it was what it in fact was. He was also, at this point, very worried about the civil liberties consequences of this kind of semi-warlike declaration. And that was, of course, also borne out when the Sedition Act was passed. By that moment, Madison really had come to see the Federalists, Adams in particular, but, you know, he'd begun thinking this about Hamilton, as essentially trying to reinscribe British monarchic government. This is the closest Madison came to, I would say, even irrationality. He would not believe, for example, that Adams was trying to end the Quasi-War, which, of course, Adams was, in fact, desperately trying to do. He was convinced that Adams wanted to keep the thing going. And he saw the Sedition Act as a fundamental violation of the First Amendment, which by our lights it was. Yeah. He saw the British-style justification that the Federalists offered. They said, well, freedom of the press never meant anything other than prior restraints. That's how it is in Britain. And Madison was horrified by that, and that's one of the things that led to the principles of 1798 and to the Virginia and Kentucky resolves.
So before we get to Jefferson winning and a kind of different posture towards these issues, so Madison basically was more or less inside the government in different capacities for the 11 or 12 years after the Constitution that he made, in effect.
He was in the House for almost all of that.
Right. That's right. Can you just give us a sense? We talked about it a little bit, but about the difference between this highly rational mind who you know thought he had this blueprint that was more or less going to work and the reality of how it hit the ground. And what was his reaction to that? How did he deal with that?
His reaction was very Madisonian. That is, he went back to his books and he rethought his assumptions. And he had designed this constitution, which to some degree was designed to make sure that the general public didn't have too much impact on political decision making. But the minute the Federalists were making decisions he didn't like, he realized that the solution to that was public opinion. So he sought to empower the public up to the point when he created a political party of pandering in a very un-Madisonian way to farmers and telling them that their lifestyle was so much better than that of the horrible, miserable people who lived in the cities or sailors. And he also sought to use the press. This is very significant for our moment. He sought to use the press in a deeply partisan way, creating a Republican newspaper to counteract the Federalist newspapers that existed. And the whole goal here, he wrote essays where he explicitly stated this, was to create a political party by manifesting the grassroots support for Republicanism that would then destroy the Federalists once and for all. So it was a political party designed to end political parties. And again, from Madison's perspective, it to some degree succeeded, because After the election of 1800, where the Federalists were defeated, they were essentially a spent force in national politics. They never controlled Congress again. They never elected another president. And, you know, by the time Madison's presidency was over, there had been 16 years of Republican presidents. Then came Monroe and the era of good feelings, which was essentially an era of one-party government. So, you know, Madison actually believed that the Republicans had once and for all defeated the heresy of Federalism.
And is that how he, this is off our point a little bit, but it's interesting, is that how he reconciled doing this with his hatred of the evil of faction?
Yes.
That he was going to wipe out the one faction that was screwing everything up and he had to use faction to do that?
Correct. It was, as he says, this may not be the language of logic, but it is the language of republicanism. He sort of realizes that his great principle, logic, which he's always believed in, logic and reason, has not got the legs to defeat a group of people whom he believed were trying to subvert the Constitution. And he called the Federalists the enemies of the Republic and the enemies of the Constitution because he thought they were trying to turn the United States into an industrial monarchy. And that, to him, was the worst possible outcome.
Right. Okay, so Jefferson wins the election of 1800. He becomes president in 1801. And Madison becomes Secretary of State for 8 years. Is that right?
Correct. The whole, all the way through the presidency. And so he's sort of the co-president.
So tell us about that, and then tell us about his stint as Secretary of State.
Well, you know, Jefferson's genius is unquestioned, but like a lot of geniuses, he had a short attention span, and it was hard to keep Jefferson's attention really focused on many aspects of governance. He would always rather discuss philosophy or come up with pet ideas or do natural experiments. Madison, for lack of a better word, was kind of single-minded. He was very focused on governance, and he was especially focused when he was Secretary of State on foreign affairs. So the day-to-day management of foreign affairs, which was a major part of the Republican view of what the presidency ought to do, because they didn't think the president should do much domestically,
right,
really fell into Madison's hands. And that job primarily entailed moderating Jefferson's radicalisms. Jefferson would get enthusiastic. Madison would try to reel him back in. A good example is the Louisiana Purchase. So they both understand they have to make the purchase. It's too good to not do it. But Jefferson is really worried, and he thinks that there has to be a constitutional amendment. And Madison thinks this is crazy for a specific constitutional reason. Jefferson's idea is, let's break the Constitution by making the purchase, because we have to do it right away or Napoleon might change his mind. Then let's go to Congress and say, we're really sorry we broke the Constitution. Can we have a constitutional amendment, sort of, you know, repairing this after the fact? And Madison knows this is a terrible idea. He just created a constitution that's supposed to be venerated. You know, Jefferson thinks no big deal to break the constitution. We should have a new one every 19 years anyway. So Madison tells him, yeah, that's not a good idea because we shouldn't admit that we violated the constitution in the first place. And over time, Jefferson goes through draft after draft of constitutional amendments. Madison keeps on tweaking him. And at some point, Jefferson realizes better not to do anything. That's a great example of Madison winning.
And it was Madison... Did he grow more pragmatic over time? Or did he become – that sounds like – I mean, the way you're describing him in the 1790s and especially there, he sounds more pragmatic than I took away from him being at the beginning of the book, where he was more bookish and – although clearly not unaware of the affairs of the world and deeply interested in them, he kind of came at those issues through books, and maybe it was a political experience that later led him to be more pragmatic.
I completely agree with that. And in fact, one of the sub-themes of the book is the arc of – innocence to experience and theory to practice. Again and again and again, Madison gets mugged by reality. And I identify with that very much from my own limited political exposure and experience. And I could see it happening to him very, very frequently. By the way, he still sometimes makes mistakes because his character is still that of trying to solve everything from a theoretical framework. And economic sanctions, which are really the focus of the last part of his career, are a great example of that.
Okay, let's move on to that, because this is really one of his central accomplishments. And could you explain it from beginning to end, and starting with how he thought it was a solution to going to war and having a republic? So you explain it.
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, the fundamental economic international problem facing the United States throughout this entire period was how to get access to ports that were controlled by Britain and by France, because those empires were excluding American shipping, and that shipping was the lifeblood of the economy. Now, the way that other great powers acted under these circumstances was to raise a navy, to use a standing army, and to use coercive force to try to get concessions. Madison was sure the U.S. couldn't do that because his playbook, which was the playbook of the Roman Empire, said that a republic that got an army or a navy turned into an empire, because the temptation was too great for a general to simply say, or an admiral, to say, I'm turning my navy on the capital or on one of the major cities, and if you don't do what I say, I'll bombard it, or to march across the Rubicon with a, you know, which could have been the Potomac, with an army. So the question was, how do you solve this problem? How do you exercise influence without force? And his answer was economic coercion. And really, economic sanctions at a significant systematic level had never really been tried. There had been boycotts during the revolutionary period, which without very much evidence for it, the Americans believed had worked. And most famously, the embargo, which was adopted by Madison and Jefferson at the very end of Jefferson's presidency under Madison's urging, was the first iteration of this economic sanctions approach. And, you know, famously it failed. And it failed because an embargo is a race. You know, if I'm not going to sell you any of my products, then you may starve. But the question is, will I starve first? And essentially, the United States did have a huge impact through the embargo on the British West Indies, which was the goal. The price of cotton went through the roof. The prices of foodstuffs went through the roof. It was a major crisis in the West Indies. The British were forced to react by finding other sources, including Canadian sources. But the American economy just couldn't take it. And so the, you know, the kind of game of chicken was lost. And then Madison did something kind of amazing by our contemporary standards, because he had to run for president in 1808, and he had just run this incredibly unpopular failed policy. He got up in public, he said he had done it, he said he was wrong, and he was going to end the embargo. And the public reelected him, or elected him, which is also kind of incredible. I mean, in our world, you don't get up and say, this was bad, I made a terrible mistake. But he did it.
But what did he learn from that episode?
What he learned from that episode was that he couldn't impose huge costs on the U.S. domestic market and hope that the British would fold. So he then tried every other possible configuration, mostly designed to play the British and the French off against each other by saying, well, we won't trade with one of you, but we will trade with the other one of you.
This was during his presidency.
This is what during his presidency. And for 4 years, the whole first term of his presidency, he keeps on thinking that he's about to solve the problem. And there are a couple of embarrassing episodes where the British ambassador tells him, yeah, we've got a solution. And then the British government in London repudiates the deal that he made with the ambassador, which is terribly, you know, humiliating, because Madison goes public and announces that he solved this problem, and then he hasn't solved the problem. And then very famously, as 1812 comes around, he makes a basic change in his approach. And he says, in addition to this promise of sanctions, we're going to introduce the threat of military force.
Can we talk about that? Because that's exactly what he was trying to avoid.
Correct.
So tell us how he reached that point.
Yeah, it's almost an 8-year process, four as Secretary of State, four as President, in which Madison has tried every possible configuration of economic sanctions, of trying to play the French and the British off against each other, and he starts to think that it's not working, that it's just not going to work, and that he has to fall back against all of his wishes, against all of his theory, on the idea of military force. Now, he still has a limited idea of what to do. Simply, it's to invade Canada, and by invading Canada, put so much pressure on the British West Indies that the British will have to concede. And he decides to do it with militia because Congress has no interest in giving him an army. I mean, Congress was embodying real Republican principles, namely no standing army. So Madison had no standing army to work with, and he had no navy to speak of, 6 frigates, not all of which were operational. So, but he felt he had no choice at least to threaten this. And the incredible irony is that in the summer of 1812, the British actually folded with just the threat of military force, without the United States actually declaring war, that they actually retracted their orders in council, which had been the effective method by which the British Navy limited American shipping, in June of 1812. But word did not reach the United States for several months, during which time, on almost the exact same date, Madison went to Congress and had them declare a war of 1812. So the incredible irony of this is that the threat of force without the actual force worked, but Madison didn't know it, and then that threw him into the War of 1812, which is itself a fascinating story.
Give us the highlights of Madison's role and his decision-making in the War of 1812.
So the first highlight is, having declared war and announced plans to invade Canada and to do it quickly, Madison could have changed his mind when word came that the British had retracted the orders in council, but he didn't. So this is Madison, the active, decisive, by our terms, presidential figure, very different from the earlier Madison. He's already taken a step. He's committed the United States to war, and he's unwilling to go back to Congress and say, you know, we don't need it now. So very crucial, decisive moment in his presidency. Next, invasion of Canada with militia. Total disaster. And a disaster for a really interesting Republican reason, namely that militia is great at defending its own hearth and home and terrible at invading everything. So 3,000 New York militia are massed by the Niagara River. The order comes to them to cross and invade. They refuse to cross. It happens multiple times. And what's more, the militia has a constitutional argument where they claim that the president cannot send them across the border without express authorization from their state legislatures. And Madison is, you know, fulminating about this. He can't believe this deviation from his own conception of what the presidential control of the militias must entail. But basically, in two long attempts, in 1812 and again in 1813, the U.S. fails miserably to invade Canada, mostly because we do not have a trained force of standing troops to do so. The British are ill-defended to begin with because they're busy fighting the Napoleonic Wars and Canada is a low consideration. We could easily have won with forces who were capable, and we lost. So the War of 1812 then is well on its way to becoming a failure, but it's not yet a disaster. What makes it a disaster is something that Madison could not have foreseen, and that is Napoleon's march into Russia. So again, think of why Madison was willing to declare war on the British Empire. The answer is they were busy elsewhere.
Right.
They had other priorities. They were fighting an existential war against Napoleon all over Europe. But when Napoleon, you know, crossed into Russia with 600,000 troops and came back 6 months later with about 20,000 troops, suddenly, the British were in a completely different geostrategic situation.
So they had to cross the Atlantic.
They had troops to send across the Atlantic. They had ships to send across the Atlantic. And here they came. And that's what led to, for example, the burning of Washington.
Right.
It's that the British sent battle-hardened troops from the Iberian Peninsula War, who knew all about how you intimidate the enemy. You burn down his capital.
Right.
You know, the battle of those troops against militia at Bladensburg outside of Washington lasted less than 2 hours. You know, something like 5,000 hastily gathered militia turned and ran. Madison was there. He was on the battlefield. He saw it happen. So, you know, things were suddenly looking very, very grim. And of course, the burning of Washington is the low point of his right. presidency. It's a high point for Dolly because she right. was very brave. But, you know, for Madison, it's a disaster. He repeatedly refused to defend Washington, even though he could have done so. So that leaves the question of why isn't Madison remembered as the worst president ever?
Yes. What is the answer to that question?
So there's a final twist to this. And the twist actually happens in Baltimore. So burning Washington was great PR, but Washington, D.C., then as now, was not strategically useful. It was just a place for the government. In contrast, Baltimore was strategically absolutely necessary because the port of Baltimore is where most of the produce that came through the Chesapeake went out to sea. So it was all important. And if the British had been able to take Baltimore, they could credibly have put a chokehold on the central part of the United States. And then it really could have actually become a war to reverse the War of Independence. Madison had been promising all along this was a second War of Independence. It really hadn't been until now. His incompetence had made it into a second War of Independence. And the British both bombarded Baltimore and sent Marines in a landing, a very dramatic landing. And in the battle that Francis Scott Key witnessed, the militia stood outside of Baltimore, and the fort defended by some American Marines, but primarily by volunteers as well, also held. When it held, the British realized that they would not be able to essentially defeat the United States and reduce it to total defeat. And that's why, you know, when we hear the story about Francis Scott Key and we think of how the national anthem came out of there, we almost don't realize how big a deal that battle was. That was actually an existential battle for the future of the United States. And the irony is the defense worked because the defense was with militia, and militia are pretty good at defense. And so that led the British to radically reconsider their strategic position. There was also another attempt to do the same thing in upstate New York that failed. And in a remarkable twist, the Duke of Wellington was asked by the Prime Minister to go to America and defeat the Americans once and for all. And Wellington wrote a letter to the Prime Minister saying, as I see it, without naval dominance on the Great Lakes and a lot more troops than you're willing to give me, I can't win. So you should just settle on a peace treaty with the status quo ante. This is all a direct result of Baltimore.
Right.
And the prime minister says, okay. And Madison, who's been praying at this point for a peace treaty, suddenly gets a peace treaty. And he saves the Republic.
All's well that ends well.
All's well that ends well. So, and then the Battle of New Orleans, you know, makes it look really, really great.
Right.
Even though, again, the war was already over when that happened.
So we only have time for two questions. I want to ask a question about what Madison learned and then the relevance of Madison for today. So at the end of the War of 1812, he had – what was his mature reflection on these – on this economic approach to foreign policy, the military approach to foreign policy, the executive's role in it? Did he come to any sort of post-1812 insights about about the scheme he set up in 1789?
He did. He came to believe that we needed a modestly sized standing army, both for self-defense and potentially for intervention abroad. Not big by our standards, perhaps 10,000 troops. Not a big navy by our standard, just several dozen warships. But nevertheless, very, very far from where he had been, certainly when he wrote the constitutional draft, and even by the time he became Secretary of State. So a very basic change. And you mentioned earlier that the standing army, the standing navy gradually start growing and they never really stop. That's basically correct, but really only beginning after the War of 1812. I agree.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's his big change of perspective on that question.
And that was, I'm not sure he could have controlled this, but it was a fateful change for the nation.
Absolutely fateful. You know, the one thing I will say about it is that in the antebellum period, you still don't have that big a military. And if you had, you might not have had the grave difficulty that the U.S. military actually faced in putting down the Southern secession. But, so by our standards, it's not that substantial an army. But it is capable of doing things like the Mexican-American War. It's capable of, you know, limited engagements that include, you know, significant international invasions. And that is fateful. And Madison could not, I don't think, have anticipated that fully. Or he did anticipate it and simply accepted that without that, you couldn't be a player in the international sphere.
And is that the main takeaway for us? There are a lot of takeaways in your book for the modern situation and the modern presidency. But is that the main takeaway for the national security presidency in modern times?
I wouldn't go quite that far. I think another major factor for Madison is that he preserved civil liberties in wartime. And to a degree that I would say is unmatched by any other president,
right.
He allowed things to happen in the country that were actually genuine threats to national security. The Hartford Convention is a great example of this. You had the New England states getting together in a public convention to discuss a separate peace with Britain and secession. No other president would have let that happen. He let it happen.
No other president did. Exactly. Anything like that happened.
Exactly.
And
no other president in wartime really has really managed to avoid suppressing at least some civil liberties for good or for ill. Madison just let it run.
And he did this on a principled basis. And what was
totally principled. And the principle was that if you can't exercise your liberties, there's no point in having a republic at all. You know, they want to go, let them go. They want to walk. That is their deep, you know, fundamental right, at least to talk about doing that. And that's a kind of extraordinary perspective that's hard to imagine subsequent presidents adopting. But to me, that is the most significant takeaway for Madison. He had seen the Sedition Act. He did not want to do that. He genuinely did not repress freedom of speech. And he tried to fight the war that he did fight within the realm of Republican principles. He still believed in the possibility of a relatively limited government. And he did want to expand U.S. territory, but he did not want the U.S. to become a global superpower. That Hamiltonian vision was still more than a century away.
All right. That's a great place to stop. This is an extraordinarily interesting book. There's much more in the book than the foreign affairs issues that we've been discussing. Noah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Thanks a lot for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Noah Feldman for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please take a moment to share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook. Tweet about it. Give it a 5-star rating in iTunes, Stitcher, or on whatever podcast distribution system you use, and make sure that all your friends know about it. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks, as always, for listening.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.